Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories. Hello, I'm Janice Gilliard.
And I'm Sharicana Feliciano. Welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Today, we are joined by our guest, Damon Fordham.
A native of South Carolina, Damon Fordham is a respected educator and devoted historian. True stories of Black South Carolina and voices of Black South Carolina are among his publications, and he has taught at Charleston Southern University, the College of Charleston, and the Citadel. He also conducts informative historical tours in Charleston, South Carolina. He draws upon all of these experiences to inform his participants. Welcome to Speak On It, Damon Fordham.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Damon. So we'll just go ahead and get started. So when did you become interested in history, and what led you to research and write and speak about it?
I was one of that last generation of Black children who grew up with elders on the porch who loved to tell stories of the things that they have experienced. In my case, my dad, through his years of World War II, segregation, and the Depression and such. Mm-hmm. So I was always interested in listening to the tales of the elders were as much fun to me as Bruce Lee and Batman were to the average kid at that time. So I had that interest, plus I also was an unathletic bookworm, so I loved to read, which made me quite strange in the eyes of most of my peers and even a lot of the adults for that matter. So when I went to the University of South Carolina, I met Dean Willie Harriford of the Black Studies Department that showed me that this is not just a hobby, that I could make a living off of this, and it went from there.
Wow, very interesting. Damon, before you share with us about the works you have written regarding Black history in South Carolina, please share with us the types of tours you give in Charleston.
It's called The Lost Stories of Black Charleston. It's an outgrowth of what I've been doing for years, really. Before all of this, I was a radio journalist, and I was also wrote a newspaper column for Congressman James Clyburn's newspaper, The Coastal Times, where I just love to tell stories. And the stories that I love to tell are things that most people don't already know because I'm constantly researching. So that's called The Lost Stories of Black Charleston. And what I do is, on a pretty constant basis, I'm constantly going through old newspapers, old magazines, and archives and interviews to the elderly, so I could put out the type of stories that most other people don't already know. And I'm very animated in my speaking style. I also have a YouTube channel called The American Storyteller, where I use all of this to draw in the public's interest and keep it there.
I love it. Wow.
So regarding your book, True Stories of Black South Carolina, says from the upstate to the low country, African-Americans have had a gigantic impact on the Palmetto State. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, their stories are often overshadowed. Right. Damon, can you please share the research of about at least two or three individuals you have highlighted in your research of True Stories of Black South Carolina?
Well, one of my favorites is the legendary Esau Jenkins. He was a Black man from Johns Island, South Carolina, who with a fourth grade education, he managed business, he owned businesses from Charleston, South Carolina, up to Atlantic Beach, South Carolina, which is about 120 miles north of us. He was also Martin Luther King's point man in Charleston, and he was willing to educate himself to become a major leader of his time. And so that I think is a very inspiring story. And one of the people who I also wrote about was a man named Sherman Cato, who in a town called Central South Carolina in 1888, a white man named Mance Waldrop lynched, raped and murdered his daughter. And he actually organized a lynch mob posse after this man and actually went to court and was taken to court and lived to tell about it.
Wow.
Sort of a real lifetime to kill, you can say.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know what? You mentioned Atlantic Beach. Now, I remember going to Atlantic Beach as a child. I'm from Marion County, South mm-hmm. Carolina. And we would go to Atlantic Beach because we were not allowed to go to Myrtle Beach.
Wow.
Are you familiar with that history?
Yeah, well, by the time I was a boy, we were allowed at Myrtle Beach. But my generation, to be totally honest with you, really didn't have a whole lot of interest in Atlantic Beach. And I'll tell you why, because if you'll remember that in the late 70s and the early 80s, you had the Pavilion at Myrtle Beach that had the roller coaster and the Ferris wheel right. and the merry-go-round and all those kinds of rides that kids like. But whereas our elders wanted to go to Atlantic Beach, but all they had at Atlantic Beach were these seaside juke joints and pool halls and dance halls. And, you know, kids aren't going to be interested in that. But, right. of course, we didn't realize the historical significance
exactly.
of an Atlantic mm-hmm. Beach. When you're a kid, you just want to go on the rides. And since Atlantic Beach didn't have the budget for the rides, we weren't interested. And that kind of thing led to a downfall of Atlantic Beach. However, I'm pleased to tell you that I was there about 3 weeks ago, and I see a lot of wealthy Black people who are now moving in and investing into Atlantic Beach so it can possibly maintain a sort of rebirth as we speak.
Right, that's powerful. Yeah, it's and that's history in the making for us.
Right.
Voices of Black South Carolina, legend and legacy. Please share with our listeners the story of the courageous Black woman in Charleston who kept her seat on a segregated streetcar 88 years before Rosa Parks' historic protest.
That was Mary Bowers. Back in 1867, you see, during the time that Reconstruction was just getting off the ground, Black people were not allowed on the streetcars of Charleston. So a group of Black people rushed on the streetcars in the spring of 1867, which led to the streetcar riot of 1867, where the Black people in the streets battled the police for their rights to ride on the streetcars. So a refined and educated Black woman named Mary Bowers got on the streetcar and she was coughing. So they tried to use that as an excuse to get her off of the streetcar. And they begged, pleaded with her to get off the streetcar. But she went before the Reconstruction government of Charleston and wrote a letter into the Charleston Courier newspaper about all this. And that led the Robert K. Scott, the Reconstruction governor, to order the streetcars be integrated. And that was the case up until the Tillman regime, that is Benjamin Tillman, the senator of South Carolina in 1895, made segregation the law of the state. It remained integrated up to that point.
Wow. So Damon, can you also share an example from Letters of Black Soldiers during the Civil War in the book?
Well, among those, you had people who were just basically, they were stationed up around what we now know as Walterboro. And mm-hmm. they were basically discussing the conditions that they were facing around that time. There were people who resented their presence there and so forth, but others who were greatly inspired by them and by the soldiers. These were in the type of regiments that you saw in the movie Glory, mm-hmm. Where you had the Massachusetts 55th. There were numerous other regiments of that kind, known as the U.S. Colored Troops during that period. In fact, I grew up in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, and I recently learned that the Massachusetts 55th was stationed in Mount Pleasant for a time during the latter part of the Civil War. And these Black soldiers taught a lot of the local Black residents how to read and write. So a lot wow. of that speaks to their untold significance. Now, how That's I right. found out about those letters that you asked me about, it turns out that there was a Black newspaper in Charleston called the South Carolina Leader in the 1860s. And I managed to find copies of that and use those stories for the book. And that's the kind of thing I like to do. I'm very big on what are called primary sources.
Right. Well, newspapers are such an underrated
source. Exactly. And the reason I got... And the reason I got into doing that in the first place was because for a time in the 1990s at the old Charleston County Library, which is now demolished, and there's a new one there now, but I was over the microfilms. And when I would go put the old newspapers on the microfilms, I found all these fascinating things that the history books missed, you see? Right. So I have this collection where I photocopied a lot of that stuff and put them in binders and such for future research. And I still use those today to get the things that nobody else gets, because so much of that is falling through the cracks.
Right. Yep.
Okay, so now, other than the letters, can you tell us something else that you found out that you have in those binders?
Oh, yes.
Something else that you'd like
to share?
A book
that I just finished writing, which is probably my favorite story in all of American history, which is about how I mentioned in passing earlier that Benjamin Tillman, who was a notoriously bigoted senator in South Carolina in the 1890s, he held a constitutional convention to disfranchise Black people from the gains that we made during Reconstruction. There were these six Black leaders, Robert Smalls, who's best remembered as the man who freed himself and his family from slavery by stowing away on a Confederate ship in Charleston Harbor. There was Thomas Miller, the founder of South Carolina State University, William J. Whipper, a Black lawyer in Charleston, Isaiah Reed and James Whig, Black lawyers in Beaufort, and Robert Anderson of Georgetown. These six courageous Black leaders stood up in the State House in the face of the worst insults and threats to raise their voices before the world to put a stop to what Tillman was doing, even so that even Booker T. Washington himself addressed Tillman by saying that in trying to disfranchise Black South Carolinians and lower their education to make them a permanent class of cheap labor, what you sow, you shall reap. And he also added that you cannot keep people in the ditch without getting dirty yourself. And their concentration on keeping the Black people down and keeping the education of Black people low is the very reason that South Carolina remained at the bottom of American literacy for years. But these men's courageous attempts, in spite of all of that, was a story that greatly inspired me. So there's a chapter in that in Voices of Black South Carolina that I just expanded into a book that should be out by the end of the year.
I love it. Love that. Many of our listeners know the story of Robert Smalls, but for those that don't, please share how Robert Smalls steered a Confederate warship into Union waters, freeing himself and some of his family, and later served in the South Carolina State Legislature. Now, I've seen a documentary on that, and it was just it's a powerful story. So for our listeners that don't know that story, can you share a little bit about that?
Well, you just told half of it, actually.
Well, but I'm sure you've got more to add to it. I mean,
I'll expand upon that. Okay, Robert Smalls, born in slavery in Beaufort, South Carolina in 1839. And was sent to Charleston in slavery, where he was a boat pilot for the Confederates. Now, let me clarify something with that. Mm-hmm. Black people did, for the most part, Black people did not voluntarily serve for the Confederacy.
Right.
What you had was that as slaves, they were forced to perform non-combatant duties, such as ditch diggers and cooks and boat pilots and messmen and that sort of thing. And that's what Robert Smalls was doing. So he got the idea while piloting the boat that while the Confederates were asleep, he would stow his family away on the ship and sail it into Union water and sail them to freedom into Union waters, which he did on the night of May the 13th, 1862. And that led to a meeting with President Abraham Lincoln, which was one of the main factors in Lincoln calling for Black regiments during the Civil War, which incidentally ties into the Emancipation Proclamation, in that part of the Emancipation Proclamation, which few people actually read, makes mention of the fact that he expects the newly freed people to fight for the Union, thus helping to win the Civil War for the Union. Now, but back to Robert Smalls. So in from January to April of 1868, they had the elections which called for Black representatives. So between January and April of 1868 at the Charleston Clubhouse on the corner of Meeting and King Streets, 76 Blacks and 48 whites gathered to rewrite the Constitution of South Carolina into one of equality. They called for anti-discrimination laws, women to have the right to divorce abusive husbands, for them to be state hospitals and mental institutions. And on January the 23rd, 1868, the great Robert Smalls got up in the Charleston Clubhouse and made the declaration, resolved all children between the ages of 7 and 14 must attend public schools at least 6 months a year under penalty of noncompliance. That was one of the first first public school laws ever enacted in the Southern United States.
Amazing. Amazing. And we do not hear about this.
And the reason you don't, well, part of, there's several reasons why you don't hear about it. Number one, most people don't know where to look for that information. I found what I just described to you in the minutes of the 1868 Constitutional Convention at the archives at the Charleston County Library. So most people wouldn't go to someplace to look for anything like that. Right. Secondly, after Reconstruction, a lady named Mildred Rutherford down in Georgia with the Daughters of the Confederacy, they passed the standards for Southern textbooks, to which they basically erased a lot of the positive contributions of Reconstruction and forced out pro-Confederate pseudo-history, denying the role of slavery in the role of creating the Confederacy and making it the Black people, that make it so, the idea that during Reconstruction, the Black people were illiterate and ignorant and were nothing but a bunch of crooks and thieves and so forth, to completely overturn that idea, which allowed people like Benjamin Tillman in South Carolina, Hoke Smith down in Georgia, and Tom Heflin in Alabama, and James K. Vardaman in Mississippi and all these other states, to overturn Reconstruction by passing the Jim Crow laws under the pretext of that false history.
And what you just said was very powerful, in that that's why you have a lot of the Confederate monuments as well all over the place, because it was like, oh no, we've got to honor them and so on. So thank you for bringing that out. But the monuments, the Confederate monuments were a part of that.
Yeah, that's with the Daughters of the Confederacy. That's
true. Yeah, people, nobody talks about that and how they basically rewrote the narrative of the Civil War.
But see, here's the thing about that. They don't talk about, people cannot talk about what they don't know.
Right.
And see, most people today get their history from the two worst places humanly possible, which is Hollywood and the internet.
Right, it's true.
You know, so, you got to go to the library.
Where should they go? Tell them where they should go.
Sometimes you have to go to those slightly boring places. I mean, hey, minutes are not exciting things to read, but you know, there's a lot of gold that can be mined.
But see, that's where scholars come in.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. See, right now, for example, I don't expect the average Jane and Joe to do the delicate research on health and science to properly inform the people about what's happening right now with COVID and vaccinations and all that. The medical scholars who make that outreach to the general public, and one of them, the best people who does that right now, and I'm very proud to say, is one of my students who from the College of Charleston, a young lady by the name of Dr. Ebony Hilton, who's been on MSNBC a whole lot. She's educating the public on the realities of vaccines and the COVID and things like that. Those of us who are scholars have a duty to go out to the general public and bring this out to them. That's one of the reasons why I admire my friend and mentor, like Dr. Henry Louis Gates, for doing a great job of that through public television, by bringing this stuff down to the level of the masses. Now, the problem with this is that so many people in academia are caught up in all this wonky terminology and dealing with and speaking far above the heads of the average person. They don't know how to communicate with the average Jane and Joe, which is one of the things that allowed the opposition to hijack the concept of CRT. And that leaves for these internet clowns to come on YouTube and Facebook and put all this gross information out there, because in times of crisis, false prophets do well. So it's like Malcolm once said of the Nation of Islam versus the Orthodox Islam he came to. He said that the silence of the people who knew true Islam made it possible for anybody to corrupt that concept and deceive the people.
Ooh, preach the word there.
Oh, gosh. You know, you mentioned Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr. Yes. My all-time favorite is his series on Reconstruction.
Yes.
I thought I knew what Reconstruction was about. I thought I knew what it was about, but until I watched that series, I learned so much. So I wrote, some of my notes are, again, and we say this all the time, it is critical to research, document, share our history, and also make sure that we are correcting. If there's a false narrative out there, it is incumbent upon us to correct the false narrative and to learn as much as we can. And I'm telling you, like, I've been researching for over 25 years, but I'm still open to learning. I'm listening to you. And so you said, well, you already talked about Robert Smalls. Look at how you were able to even add more to that.
Like, well, I was being somewhat flippant with that, as you could tell. I mean, it's going to be obvious to anybody who sees this, but people who might just hear my voice not know that. But yes, it is, because right now you have these idiots and clowns on YouTube who are brainwashing and misleading the youth with such nonsense, like Black people who were here before the Native American Indians, and Harriet Tubman was a fictional character, and all this. I mean, they are putting all this stupidity out there. But because there is such a hostility to actual Black history being taught in schools, and you have the young people now who in many cases don't have the kind of parents who can teach them real history, it's basically, like I said earlier, in times of crisis, false prophets will do well. And so this is what's going on. And so that's why, and then throughout Black History Month on Facebook, you see people putting all these posts out there with misinformation. Now, because of our experiences as a people, it left a lot of our ancestors with wounded egos. Yeah. Many of them really, they were told for so long that they were ignorant and inferior that they came to believe that they were good at all things physical and nothing mental, okay? Right. Because I've always told people, James Brown wouldn't have had to say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud, if so many people were not made to feel ashamed of it in the first place. Mm-hmm. Jesse Jackson wouldn't have had to say, I am somebody, if the people weren't made to feel that they were nobody. People wouldn't go around saying Black Lives Matter unless for many people, Black lives didn't matter. Right. So that creates this vacuum where you have these things on Facebook right now, the ones going around saying that people did cornrows as maps to help them go places during slavery and all. I'm like, what? Are you serious? But because people are so starved for positive information, they will latch onto things like that, what I call weapons of mass distraction.
And misinformation.
Okay. But getting back to what you said about Dr. Gates and the Reconstruction documentary, all that shows is this, something I've learned a long time ago. That's why I keep researching, because the more you learn, the more you learn there is to learn.
Right.
Yes, that's
true. So very true. So Black history is American history, obviously, you know?
Well, Black history is history, period.
That's right.
They it so. Is.
That's right. And I was going to ask, how would you respond to that statement? And you basically responded to it. It's American history, period.
Well, it's history, period.
Yeah. It's history, period. Right. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts then on the International African American Museum being built in Charleston?
Well, you know, the more the merrier as far as that kind of thing goes. I'm in favor of anything. You know, I'm not officially affiliated with them, but they've hired me from time to time to do projects for them. I was, in fact, one of the people that okayed a number of the tag descriptions they've had for some of the exhibits and all of that. So I'm not against anything like that, as long as you're putting out accurate information. I'm for it. Anything that gets this information to the general public that is legitimate in a manner in which the general public can understand, I'm for that.
I have a quick question. This is going back. As a part of your tour, I saw something where it said you also do the walking tours. Do you ever go near the Slave Mart in Charleston?
Oh, yes. I make sure I definitely go by that to show, because most people have never seen an actual Slave Mart. And while we're on that subject, a couple of things I have to say about that. The actual Slave Mart in Charleston was on number 6 Chalmers Street. That's the only one that's still standing as such. Many people often erroneously refer to a larger open air market on Market Street as the Slave Market, but it was never such a thing, because that one was owned by Charles Coatsworth Pinckney, who, while he was in fact the slave owner, he did not want slave sales to take place at that open air market. Why? Because you see, while people owned and purchased enslaved people during those days, the idea of open air slave sales and all that was considered too disreputable because the sight of people splitting up families and all that, having that out in the open just gave it a bad name. And one thing they didn't want to do was to hold themselves up to that kind of public scrutiny, you see. Right. So they weren't sold at that one. There was an open air market over by where the old exchange building is today on the corner of East Bay and Broad Street, though, which is they shut that down because people complained about the separation of families and them parading them around and chains naked. So they shut that down and moved it to where the Slave Mart on Chalmers Street stands today in 1856.
Wow.
You're like a walking encyclopedia.
Yes.
Funny you should say that. People have been telling me that ever since I was a kid, but this is just what I do, you know? I mean,
it's true. It's true. This is what you do. This is true. Okay. Damon, please share some parting words of inspiration with our listeners regarding history, little bit of genealogy, because I know you do some family research as well, but if you could please share with our listeners. I don't even want this to end. It's like so many other questions that I want to ask, but maybe we'll have you come back, but we'd like to close with that. I'd be happy to do that. Absolutely.
Well, if you want some closing words from me, again, one of the things that's happening right now is that because of the people who have created the concept of critical race theory have such a difficult time in breaking that down to layman's terms, that's allowed other people to hijack it for their own purposes and making it into what it actually isn't. Mm-hmm. So my best response to all of that is a quote from a Vietnamese revolutionary named Phan Boi Chau, who died in 1940. He was in prison for advocating the freedom of people of Vietnam. And in a book that he wrote called The Prison Diary, he said some words that I think are appropriate to close with. The only thing that people fear is that my eyes might see and ears might hear.
Wow.
A word again. And also very timely. You know, I keep thinking about what you said about, false prophets in times of crisis. And as historians, genealogists, it just feels like, you know, it's our due diligence. We have to do our due diligence, and we really need to, you know, do our part.
Well, we do, because you see, when you think about it for a moment, Egypt rose, Egypt fell, Babylon rose, Babylon fell, Rome rose, Rome fell. And the British Empire rose, British Empire fell, Soviet Union rose, Soviet Union fell. You know, the thing to understand about that is that nations that are easily deceived are easily destroyed. So that's why the educated have to get together with the uneducated to prevent that from happening.
That's right. And in the age of technology, the age of information, you know, ignorance is a choice.
Well, technology is only good according to who uses it and why.
Now, the end user.
Right, exactly. That's true. Damon, thank you so much for sharing with us and our listeners. True Stories of Black South Carolina and Voices of Black South Carolina, Legend and Legacy are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. We thank you for joining us, and we look forward to sharing with you during our next segment of Speak On It.
You're welcome.
Speak On It is a podcast and is immediately available to listen to at your leisure. We are forever thankful to Bernice Bennett, who hosted research at the National Archives and beyond, for entrusting us to carry on her broadcast legacy through Speak On It. Thank you.